96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPVLP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. I'm Stephanie Coachman with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, July 8th. Here's what's happening across the Sun Coast. Governor Ron DeSantis is taking aim at Manatee County as part of his ongoing Florida DOGE initiative. The Bradenton Herald reports the governor criticized county spending during a recent press conference in Bradenton that highlighted his property tax cut plans, referring to ongoing statewide efficiency audits of local government by the Florida DOGE. He accused Manatee County of carrying out capital projects without proper planning. He did not specify the projects. County leaders have pushed back, creating their own DOGE committee. After their meeting July 28th, Manatee County commissioners will review results from both the state and local audits. And staying in Tallahassee, Governor Ron DeSantis vetoed a bill sponsored by Sarasota Representative Fiona McFarland that would have expanded sovereign immunity protections for government agencies. Supporters said the measure could provide greater legal certainty for public entities. Opponents argued it could make it more difficult for Floridians to recover damages in negligence cases. Back here at home, one of Bradenton's most recognizable properties could soon help address one of the region's biggest challenges. A new affordable housing development is planned near the former DeSoto Square Mall. According to the Bradenton Herald, the proposal would bring hundreds of housing units to the area as redevelopment continues around the long vacant mall site. Local leaders have identified workforce housing as one of Manatee County's most pressing needs amid continued population growth and rising housing costs. The Sun Coast is also seeing continued investment in preserving the region's natural spaces. Sarasota County Commissioners voted yesterday to purchase 2 acres to expand Sleeping Turtle Preserve near Snook Haven in South Sarasota County. County officials say the acquisition would protect more environmentally sensitive land, improve wildlife habitat, and create additional opportunities for hiking and nature recreation as the preserve continues to grow. And that commitment to conservation continues just up the road. Sarasota is inviting the community to celebrate another milestone at Bobby Jones Nature Park. A ribbon-cutting ceremony is scheduled for Monday morning to mark completion of Phase 1 of the restoration project. The first phase includes more than 200 native trees and palms, as well as over 18,000 native shrubs and grasses planted across the park. I'm Stephanie Coachman, and those are your WSLR News headlines. Until next time, stay informed, stay engaged, and stay grounded.
Good morning, good morning. This is Tom Walker with the Peace and Justice Report. I'm here every other Wednesday from 9 to 10, and my friend Bob Connors is on the alternate Wednesdays. And let me remind you, the views and opinions expressed by our hosts, guests, or callers on WSLR programs are our own. I do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. Our guest today is Ethan Weiss. Ethan is a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist specializing in mental health treatment for children, adolescents, young adults, and families. He holds both masters of social work from Loyola University in Chicago and a master's of child development from the Erickson Institute in Chicago. Prior to opening his practice at Jessen Therapy, Ethan was lead clinician at Herrera Psychology in Osprey, Florida, where he provided individual therapy for youth and their families, collaborated with other professionals to create networks of support for clients, and offered workshops and speaking engagements to build awareness and reduce stigma around mental health. He previously worked as the middle school director of counseling and academic services at the Out-of-Door Academy in Lakewood Ranch. Before entering the mental health field, this is interesting, he studied theater at Skidmore College, trained in Russia with the Moscow Art Theater, and in a graduate intensive in classical theater at Shakespeare and Company, which wonderful company, in Lenox, Massachusetts. No matter the setting or the client, Ethan believes that the most effective therapy takes place in the context of an open, dynamic, relationship. As a result, his primary goal is to create a therapeutic environment that encourages dialogue, flexibility, humor, and spontaneity in pursuit of client-directed treatment goals. His website, by the way, is a wonderful website. You should take a look at it. YesAndTherapySRQ.com. Welcome, Ethan. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you were on a panel here at WSLR after a film we showed called Can't Look Away. It was about the youth using online services and getting we can talk about that later, but I know you've been to WSLR before, but first tell us a little bit more about your life, your work earlier in the theater, and how it led to this, and so forth.
Sure. Well, I am a Sarasota native, born and bred, and I'm a second generation here. My grandfather, Dr. Norman Goldstein, was one of the first pediatricians and one of the first developmental pediatricians in town. And my mom is Diane Weiss, who co-founded 40 Carats Family Center. And my dad, Dr. Robert Weiss, pediatrician as well for 40 years. And then I picked up my practice here once I moved back from all the things you mentioned with my theater work. Training for child and adolescent, young adult mental health support at the Erickson and Loyola, and now I am a local here with my own kids and my wife of 15 years. So it's been a road that is sometimes felt circuitous, but when you zoom out, there is a lot of clarity and logic.
Just one second, Eric. I'm having trouble making your mic work, and I don't know what I did wrong. He's on number three. Yeah, okay. I'm good now?
Yep.
Thank you so much. Eric, I want you
to, Ethan.
This is our overall boss. Thank you. Thank you.
No problem. You're on now.
Okay. Well, I got to take that training course. Try. We only wasted 3 minutes. Let's go through that again. And Eric Weiss.
Ethan.
All right, man.
That is okay.
It's not always like this.
No, that's fine.
Ethan Weiss.
The truth is that Eric Weiss is Harry Houdini's real name. So you're summoning a different guy, but a man of some real solid cultural resonance. And I'll share space.
Okay. Licensed clinical social worker Ethan Weiss is on our program today. In case you didn't hear, I hope you heard that part. And if you could start again, tell us a little bit more about your life.
Absolutely. So my name's Ethan Weiss. I'm a Sarasota native, and I'm actually third generation here. My grandfather, Dr. Norman Goldstein, was one of the first pediatricians in town.
Wow.
And one of the first developmental pediatricians there was. And my mom is Diane Weiss. She is a co-founder of 40 Carats Family Center.
Yeah.
And my dad, Dr. Robert Weiss, practiced pediatrics for 40 years. And so I did theater for the first part of my life. I was a Booker VPA grad. Went to Skidmore College in upstate New York, where I studied theater in a kind of a liberal arts setting.
Uh-huh.
And after that, I went to a training program in Lenox, Massachusetts, Shakespeare and Company.
Yes.
Where I met my wife doing it's so sweet. It makes your teeth hurt. We were doing Romeo and Juliet, and the two of us
wow.
I know. So we met there, and she talked sense into me. And we moved to Chicago after that together, where we pursued theater a little bit and then found our own niches that were different. Mine was mental health and with a focus on kids, young adults, families. And Katie found a path in digital advertising in a a pretty powerful way, and also in the arts. She's a designer as well.
Mm-hmm.
Her website is Art by Katie Weiss. It's incredible what she is capable of, web design, interior design, and visual arts as well. She's a painter. So we moved back here when my first kid was on the way, and we've been here now since 2014, and it sometimes feels like the road is long and winding, but when you zoom out, there's such a beautiful pattern and logic to how all of these opportunities and experiences have led one into the other, and also how they inform my work as a psychotherapist and allow me to sit in a space, hopefully, with this presence that I hope allows my clients to the feeling of connection.
What made you switch from theater to therapy?
I mean, it's not going to surprise you too much, but it's not that far of a leap. I mean, both professions are about listening if you're doing them right.
Yes.
And one of my mentors always said that the best actors make their scene partners look great.
That's true.
So if your goal is, I want to make the person on stage with me look 10 times better than they actually are, then I'm doing my job.
Yes.
Now, when it comes to therapy, psychotherapy, if I can create a space where I'm listening in a way where somebody can hear themselves differently or see themselves as they could be or as they wish to be, then it allows them the possibility that change can happen, that growth is a path they can follow. And all we really need sometimes is that belief, that possibility that change can happen to allow a little bit of change to start to occur. And once change occurs, it can snowball and we can get to a place we didn't think we were capable of getting.
It's
pretty cool. So the two of them do connect.
But
I found myself in this field. It's also connected to, you know, my family history, as I mentioned, to find a place that is service oriented, that's about being present with people. But also there's that theatrical component of I get to play out these 1 hour scenes, these plays where there is a beginning, middle, and end, hopefully, and there's an opportunity for people to explore thoughts, ideas, ways of looking at the world that are ultimately liberating or healing. That's the goal, and whether it happens every time or not, I'm not sure, but it definitely makes an hour feel meaningful.
Yeah. I remember I took some improv at one time. Yes, Sam, is a standard instruction. You acknowledge and you agree with what's been done or said, and then you take it further, right?
Absolutely. That's the premise that I'm working on when I am in a room. And it's also guidance I give to the people I work with, especially parents, caregivers, and it's stuff I use in as a parent myself, is how can I find a way to agree with part of the premise that I can agree with and then build off of that in a direction that I'm comfortable going. It makes me more creative and it keeps me out of my amygdala, the part of my brain that reacts from an emotional space.
Oh.
Because when I'm receiving whatever my kids are giving me, instead of going straight to no, but, and then we're at odds.
Right.
If I can say, and we can start with flossing your teeth instead of brushing your teeth, or which would you rather do, or do you want to head and take that shower first, or do you want to get straight into your pajamas? If both of those are equal to me, then this allows us to partner and build a scene together, essentially, rather than me taking on this role of director. And if there's partnership, if there's collaboration, I'm also scaffolding autonomy and empowering my kids, which right now, more than anything, what I see a need for kids, adolescents, young adults, is this sense of their own agency. The fact that they are capable of handling challenging things. And I want to say this generation is spectacular. I am so impressed. So this is not coming from a place of judgment. It is just with so much information coming in, with so many challenges of global scale and local scale at their fingertips and inundating their minds all the time, 24/7.
Yeah.
It can feel like there is it can cause a person to feel less powerful or less capable than they actually are. Because where do you start? Where do you pick up the piece of the spaghetti and start to slurp?
Right.
And these small moments of empowerment from the time our kids are really, really young, where we're giving them the chance to make choices and navigate mm-hmm. the consequences mm-hmm. In a healthy, scaffolded way, is critical to helping them find their way to becoming adults who can do the very same.
Mm. You should write a book for parents.
I mean, maybe, but every time I sit down to try and write something, I'm struck by how much I don't know.
Oh, maybe Case Histories, anonymous so Case Histories.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. When we talked a while back, you said there was one thing. You were a particular topic you were interested in talking about, and let's talk about it a little bit today. You said that it's important to tell the difference, to be able to tell the difference, differentiate between being uncomfortable and being unsafe. Mm-hmm. Would you explain that and what your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I think, and I don't think this is just an issue or a challenge for youth. I think this is a broader cultural thing that we're dealing with, where because of the intensity and the, like I said, the amount of stuff we're taking in and we're holding and the size of much of it, global scale
yeah.
of these things that we're holding, there can be a tendency that when we face something that is uncomfortable in our lives, something that's different or out of our typical experience, and that causes us to feel agitated or unsure, we code that as unsafe or scary. And as a result, we pull back. This is very understandable for
right.
youth, and it's also understandable for adults.
Sure.
The good thing about that is that it's part of the hardwired system to make sure that we keep ourselves safe. It is all about making sure that we stay safe.
Sure.
That is what our apparatus is here to do. That's the great part. The challenge is that every time we pull back from something that makes us feel uncomfortable, we limit our ability to experience it in a different way and find that something that we thought was uncomfortable is actually something that we can better understand, that we can make meaning out of, or that deepens us as a person. We expand our worldview. We expand our compassion, our empathy, our capacity to see other people in a more nuanced way, because we're taking on experiences that challenge the way we see the world. Now, unsafe is different. And that is where, you know, physically, psychologically, emotionally, there is clear and present danger. We are unable to manage the situation because there is no benefit, because we're at capacity for our ability to regulate and manage it. And at those moments, finding safety is
sure
everything. But there are so many experiences in life where our true safety, our true physical, mental, emotional integrity is not at risk, where if we stayed 5 minutes longer with curiosity, we might discover something that changes everything. And if we build that in early, then our kids become adolescents who can do a job that at first feels uncomfortable. I don't know what I'm doing here. I feel like I don't know mm-hmm. how to manage it. And they stick with it because it feels uncomfortable. It feels like they're doing everything wrong. We've been there. We've been in a role that feels over our head or like it's too much. And then we sit in it and it sucks. It really sucks. I hate it. And we go back And we come home and we complain. It sucks. I suck. The whole thing sucks. And when we come home and we go back, and each day it gets incrementally more familiar. And before we know it, we're like the, you know, frog in the pot that was boiled before he caught wise. We know what we're doing, and we don't remember how we got there.
Right.
But now we can do jobs that at the beginning of this experience we thought were completely outside of our scope. And I think that applies to relationships, friends who navigate things differently than us, or people who come at experiences in a novel way because their family or their culture of origin is different than ours, that at first seems inscrutable, but we spend time with it and suddenly we get this nuance or this complexity that, again, adds to our wisdom by giving us respect for this feeling of not knowing, this beginner mind, a comfort of not yet having clarity, and shifting that feeling from danger to maybe a little bit of excitement.
Mm-hmm.
What's here that I don't see? What am I going to learn from this experience?
Mm-hmm.
And if we can make that shift, that fundamental shift in how we perceive that moment, oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
We are, one, we're just a much better hang for people to be around.
Yeah.
And two, how much more beautiful does the world become?
Mm-hmm. So. Wow. Wow. And unsafe. What people should be able to tell pretty clearly what's unsafe, right? Or what would you what have you seen in your practice where you would warn people that it was unsafe? Are you talking about dangerous individuals or dangerous activities? Or what are the unsafe things kids should not get into? Drugs or
well, I mean, there's the pretty straightforward stuff that has long-term consequences. So, you know, substances, of course, are in that category of unsafe. I mean, if we're pulling these things, some of the concerning areas that can become unsafe are, you know, we're seeing a rise in adolescent online gambling. That's sports betting. Like that is in all of the literature that I'm seeing, there's a pretty steep rise in that. Is much more common than I think people are aware of. There are subcultures about, that are becoming less sub about, body image, for guys as well as for girls and women. So like there are these areas that are at first an uncomfortable situation. You know, I feel discomfort, and then the way that I manage that discomfort, the, you know, dopamine dump of, or that pleasure dump that I get from gambling, or the relief I get from a substance or a maladaptive coping strategy like that, then becomes unsafe because the path I've chosen to manage it is unsustainable and ultimately it does harm. Truly unsafe situations are, I think we could look at as situations where a person is having their individual integrity and agency taken from them, or they're in physical, emotional, psychological distress that damage can be done that the damage can be done. Whereas these unsafe things, while they initially may share some physiological similarities, like my heart rate goes up, or I'm sweating, or, you know, I feel really tense. You know, this can exist in both, but what they mean is different. And that's where the reading it is super important, and where we can get it a little bit wrong.
You can teach them the difference.
Right? Well, I hope so, or at least scaffold the questioning of, is this a situation where I am in danger, where somebody is trampling on my efficacy, on my personal agency, on my identity,
mm-hmm.
In a way that is causing me great pain,
mm-hmm.
Or is this a situation where I am feeling uncomfortable because there's something that I can learn from it, or there's something I can explore?
Talk about some of the other problems you see and deal with, and some of your success stories.
Okay. Well, a lot of what I work with is anxiety, and I also work a fair amount with what we would call depression, in that, and I say what we call depression because depression can look a lot of different ways. Of course, it can look, especially in adolescents and kids, it doesn't necessarily look sad. Depression in kids and adolescents can look like irritability. It can look like sullenness.
Oh.
It can look like a behavioral change that is persistent over time. That's like, hey, we're just seeing this shift. I don't want to create fear or worry in parents that suddenly they're seeing something and this has to be depression, you know?
Yeah.
You hear hoofbeats, we don't automatically go to zebras, right? We think horses first and then we work our way. But it's important to know that it doesn't always just look sad. I mean, changes in sleep and eating habits also are heavily correlated with depression. So I deal with or support people who are experiencing a wide range of this.
Yeah.
Often I would say that at a core piece of it, and it's too simplistic of me to boil it down to one thing.
Sure.
And I think that there is a core piece that is similar with a lot of these situations. And that is a lack of connection or a feeling of disconnect. What I mean by that is a loss of connection from other people, clearly. A loss of connection from purpose and meaning. I don't feel like what I do has value or substance. A lack of connection or a loss of connection to the natural world. I feel really cramped inside my little space,
mm-hmm.
and the world feels small and intense and overwhelming because it's the size of, you know, a matchbox. Mm-hmm. Loss of connection to something bigger that mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily mean religion.
Right.
But some perspective that allows us to catch our breath, not feeling like everything is a flashpoint, or everything is the most important thing that has ever happened, because that can bring incredible amounts of stress. And talk about starting to code things as unsafe, that might be uncomfortable, but if we have a hard time stepping outside and seeing that larger perspective, those smaller things can feel magnified.
Mm-hmm.
And if something is magnified, our body reacts to it in its magnified state. And so we run, mm-hmm. or we keep ourselves safe. Fight, flight, freeze, mm-hmm. or fawn.
Mm-hmm.
We go into the classic four.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you know, I've heard somebody use the example of a person who's afraid of spiders. And when this person who has a fear of spiders imagines a spider, they don't imagine a spider like somebody who doesn't have a fear of spiders,
right.
where they see this little spider,
right.
and they're like, ah, it's a spider, you know. What they imagine is this 5 foot wide, 4 foot tall tarantula that's, you know, 2 inches away from their face. And that's how their body reacts. So part of the support, part of the treatment, is to help that person in their mind's eye take that gigantic tarantula and move him back to size.
Mm-hmm.
Transform him back into the, you know, tiny little itsy-bitsy spider that went up the water spout that it actually is, and allow the body to regulate back to a place where it's going, oh, no, 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 no. I don't like this spider. I'm not going to invite him over for coffee. But he is not the threat that my body is reacting to.
Right.
And so that's a lot of what I do, whether it's that kind of fear response or that intense response to homework. You know, I've got this paper I need to write, and it produces the same level of fear that a 5-foot-long, 3-foot-high tarantula that's a foot away from my face would.
Sure, sure.
And so, you know, a parent or a caregiver will say, like, why are you avoiding this homework? You know you have to do it, and you know the consequence. But if we shift our perspective to, well, what if it was experienced like a giant spider? Well, then you kind of get why you wouldn't want to reach in your backpack and pull out a giant spider.
Right, right.
So first, before we can say, hey, let's introduce some of these, you know, executive functioning or getting your work done strategies, we have to address the size of the spider. We have to make the agitation or the fear of this really significant challenge more manageable. And then we can start to build some systems in place to help scaffold kids, adolescents, young adults, and even adults ourselves as caregivers and parents' successes. So that's kind of like a broader thing. I know I'm not being super specific about, like, this walked in my front door and I dealt with it. But I feel like it's – what I hope is that there is some ease and some comfort in knowing that there is common DNA in most of these challenges, that it doesn't set a person apart, that a person who's experienced anxiety or depression or is just having a challenging time in life because they're going through an adjustment,
right?
They're not on different planets. They're not miles apart.
Right.
There is this core sense of connection that it is hard to be a person. And if we come from that place of allowing us to have some grace and practicing self-compassion, I know that can sound a little hokey sometimes, but if we can make
that's a good idea.
But it is a practice, and it is hard to be like, hey, it is tough to be a person, and I'm going to do the best I can today and build from there.
We're talking to Ethan Weiss of Yes and Therapy, SRQ.com. I love reading your web pages and finding out all of the different things you deal with.
Thank you.
You deal with anxiety, depression, executive dysfunction. I'm not sure what that is.
Well, I'll give you a quick description of it. Executive dysfunction is a fancy way of saying I have a hard time organizing myself or getting stuff done.
Being the executive, yeah.
Exactly. The CEO of our brain is they need a leadership retreat where they can get somebody to help them with Excel spreadsheets and workflows and stuff. That's part of it.
And you stress and so forth. You also help, I noticed, with anxiety, depression, also autism spectrum disorders. That's unusual. I have a grandson who's on the spectrum.
Cool.
You know, and he just graduated from Princeton with high honors. He's fine.
So he's great. Wow.
He's doing okay.
Yeah.
But he's still a little strange.
Same.
So you could even I think what the key to your what I read on your website is the key to your practice is it's a solution focused brief therapy. I think that's one of the things you mentioned, SFBT. What is that exactly? It sounds marvelous.
Well, doesn't it really? And I want to be clear that, you know, the way I approach my work is I know you mentioned earlier client directed or client focused, right? So when I show up in a room, part of the yes and is to figure out where the person is at the moment I am meeting them.
Right.
And then with them, constructing a path forward that makes sense to them. So there are all these therapeutic and theoretical modalities and models, and they all have some many of them, rather, have some really great insight and tools that we can use.
Mm-hmm.
And brief treatment or solutions-focused therapy is great for a lot of things. What it does, basically, is it I mean, it does what it sounds like it does. We focus on a very specific issue or challenge or goal. And then we figure out the steps to accomplish that goal. I wish I could make it sound fancier than that, because I feel like I'm like talking myself out of a job when I make it sound so obvious.
No, it's hard to do.
But it is harder than it sounds. So I'll give you a quick example.
Yeah.
You know, one of the famous activities or strategies of solution-focused therapy is this thing called the miracle question. The miracle question is, you say, okay, let's imagine that you go to bed tonight and a miracle happens, and that thing that you want to change or you want to be different, it actually occurs.
Right.
You wake up the next day, you come downstairs. What is the first thing you notice that tells you that that change has happened? Now, what this does is it takes us from the realm of abstract when we're thinking about changes, like I'm going to feel better, or I'm going to get along with people better, and it starts to specify, well, you know, I will have energy and I will go outside and I'll take a long walk, or I will look at my phone and there will be messages from 15 people who are my friends and want to see how I'm doing. Now we have a path because we went from I want to have friends or I want to be connected to I want to have reciprocal relationships, and we can take that next step up the workflow. That's a mixed metaphor. We can climb up that workflow ladder to the one right above it, which is, okay, so what would we need for those text messages to come in on our phone? Well, we would need at least 15 people that are your pals. Okay, well, where are we going to meet 15 people? How are we going to connect with those 15 people? What is the thing? We need to start with one. Where can we meet one person? Do you already have one person that you can build connection with? What would it take for you to take the relationship you have with this person from where it is now and move it in the direction of something that feels more meaningful or more reciprocal or more substantive in the way that you want your relationships to be? Now we've taken this elephant that you were trying to eat the whole thing of, and we took it down to a toenail. And famously, and I do not recommend this. I think there's probably some very good legal structure around stopping people from doing this, but it seems like it would be easier to eat the toenail of an elephant than the entire elephant.
Sure.
So I think with solution focus, one of the main thing, again, we're doing the thing that we did with the spider, just in a different sense. We're taking this thing that we are perceiving as a gigantic, massive, overwhelming, abstract weight and impossible, insurmountable challenge that is defeating and limits our ability to feel like we have a step to take, and we bring it down to the size of our life, something that we can do today that will move us in the direction of that, which is great, because then what we do is we reframe change and progress from fireworks. It has to be the biggest thing in the world to the scale of, hey, did you do something today that was different than you did yesterday, that was in the direction that you want to go? Yes, that's what progress looks like.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
that's the building blocks.
Right.
You see these Lego Death Stars. It's not one big piece.
Uh-huh.
The thing starts out, my son, his floor is covered in them. It is, it's a minefield.
Right.
But they start as these tiny, virtually insignificant little shiny pieces. And then you leave his room for, you know, an hour and a half. You come back and it is, a space station.
Mm-hmm.
And I think remembering that these things are made up of component parts that are much more manageable than the whole is a huge part of that solutions focused. but it's also part of each one of the modalities that I use, which is about figuring out, okay, one, let's take the big stuff, identity and meaning and purpose and relationships and connections, and then also allowing people, hopefully, to experience progress and change, because that's what we want to feel too. That's why we come to, that's why we do therapy. That's why we approach, we reach out for support, because the way things are is feeling stuck or insufficient, and we want to change. So if we can spot the changes when they happen, build on those incrementally, and feel like, hey, there is momentum here. We are building inertia. Man, it can be hopeful.
Sure. Yeah. It's progress, right?
It's progress. It's progress. Yeah.
You agree on these little, precise, realistic goals, right? And they see them accomplished, and they feel better because something has been done.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty magical when you see it. And in the words of, though the challenge is, and I get the privilege of being able to see this because of my work, and it's so longitudinal. It happens over time, and I can watch it happen as time-lapse film with watching these young people grow. Mm-hmm. Since it's during such a critical period, I'll work with a sixth grader, and then I'll see them again. I'll work with them through high school. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable. I mean, to see how they change and shift and grow. And I think to pull a phrase from a community, I think it's the recovery community that has such great one-liners. The one that really sticks with me is time takes time. And for so much of development, you know, and one of my big goals is I try desperately to avoid pathologizing development, pathologizing childhood.
Yeah.
There are a lot of challenges. Right. And, you know, these things that people experience, our experience are real. And while we are navigating these things, there are few variables that are as impactful as time. So if we can buy ourselves some time to sit in a moment, like mm-hmm. I was saying earlier with that feeling uncomfortable, if we can buy ourselves some time to sit in that,
mm-hmm.
this magic thing happens, which in the micro is this it's this magical thing called boredom. Or if we want to be fancier about it, we can call it habituation, or we become used to something.
Mm-hmm.
Because the truth is, even the scariest movie in the world, if it played the same scary music and had jump scares for an hour and a half straight with nothing else, after about 15 minutes or maybe less, mm-hmm. you'd be bored.
Right.
You'd be so habituated to this being the case,
right.
it would no longer produce that threat or that fear. So allowing ourselves time to habituate to a situation or a way of things, or become bored even, or I use that kind of a shorthand for our body kind of coming out of that heightened arousal state back to a regulated central nervous system, then we can teach ourselves, this is not a dangerous situation. I am capable of more. I'm capable of managing this. And we fold into our personality this idea that, hey, this is something that we can manage. And the next challenge we meet that is similar to that, well, now we already have evidence that we can handle that. So we can handle that, and we can handle one step higher.
So
and it's incremental.
Success, track of success.
And when you watch that happen, sometimes it takes time. It takes years, because middle school and high school can be so, and college as well, and early adulthood can be so challenging and overwhelming and confusing that sometimes the change in the progress is happening and it's hard to see it because it'll feel like two steps forward, one step back.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you zoom out or you smash cut from ninth grade to, you know, the 11th grade, uh-huh. the 14-year-old to the 17-year-old, it's like you're wondering how did we get so sophisticated? How did this kid mm-hmm. become this like young adult? And it's remarkable. And all of these skills that we address or that we offer, the work we do about boiling things down to incremental steps are deeply indicated in that growth and how it unfolds and how supported a person feels navigating that difficult journey. But kids, young adults, adolescents are resilient. People are resilient. And it's kind of delightful to be in a role where I get to remind people of what they already possess.
Yes, it must be really rewarding to see them make progress.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you're quite different from a psychiatrist, of course, which is a medical doctor. Mm-hmm. They go back into the past and they, what might have, it's a kind of a negative way to look at, look what went wrong here.
Hey, I'm going to stand up for my psychiatrist friends here because, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats and the people in mental health who practice the way I practice, we share this perspective mm-hmm. of, person focused, humanistic, meaning that we are considering the impact of meaning and purpose on an individual's life. There's this psychotherapist. He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. His name was Viktor Frankl. I don't know if you know him.
I have a psych degree.
Oh, well, there you go. And like the classics. I mean, like yeah. you got to go back to them. And Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor, and he was in Auschwitz. And when he was released and in the process of rebuilding his identity and his life and writing this book and devoting himself to psychotherapy, he started to key in on that question of, you know, what allows a person to endure the extremities of human experience.
Good question.
And what he came down, I think it is Man's Search for Meaning. And what he said, what he came to is, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't think I'm getting exactly, but a person with a sufficient why can manage or can endure nearly any how. If we have a reason, if we have a meaning or a purpose that we can orient ourselves around, our capacity to navigate challenges increases exponentially. Because then we're not alone in this. It's not from ground level. Again, it doesn't need to be spiritual, though that is one path that people take and find great comfort and clarity in. But it can be from the point of I'm here as a protector. I'm here to care for other people, or, you know, I'm lending my strength so other people can borrow it, or however we choose to define it. So the psychiatrists, the licensed clinical social workers, the licensed mental health counselors, you know, physicians who work in mental health, and nurses, nurse practitioners who do so much of this work, PACs, the
mm-hmm.
rest,
mm-hmm.
In general are finding a shift towards being partners and following the lead of their clients or their patients. And while there is still very much a let's figure out what happened so that we can understand or contextualize mm-hmm. where you are now, which I think is very, very important, by
mm-hmm.
the way,
mm-hmm.
but less from a Freudian kind of like, tell me about your mother and you're lying on the couch. Though anyone who wants to lie down is welcome to.
I have
a very comfortable
right.
couch. What is important about that is supporting people in making sense of their own story. Because what we are essentially, I think, and I say this with this expertise, but it's really just a theory. And not what I'm making up, but what I really am drawn to. We're autobiographical narrative. We are the story we tell about ourselves, which means we have an opportunity to rewrite. We can edit. We can change the meaning of an episode or a chapter in our story from where we stand. And that can shift so much. That goes to meaning. That goes to identity. And so asking about somebody's past or following their lead if the past is relevant to the story they're telling now, which it often is, is all about constructing what comes next.
Mm-hmm.
Because the client is, in some ways, one of the ways to think about it, and I'll sometimes say this, like, my client is not the person who's sitting in front of me. My client is them 10 years from now. It's future Tom. It's not present Tom.
Right.
So I'll often be like, what could you do today that future Tom would call me on the space-time telephone and be like, thank you for getting present Tom, past Tom, to do this?
Right.
And often when you think about it in that term, it's like, well, if I bring one grain of sand every day for 6 billion years, suddenly I got a sand dune.
Yeah.
So if Tom's 10 years out and he's saying, tell Tom, thank you for taking a walk. Because now I'm running marathons. It doesn't have to be that grandiose. But so anyways, that was me kind of standing up, because you're right. I am different. A psychiatrist does deal with medication and psychopharmacology because of their medical background. And some of them do psychotherapy as well. And
I like your way better, really.
Well, and I'll tell you what, you know, there are psychiatrists in town who are so great and so similar in the way they practice to the way I practice. They just have this other tool set that they use. And by the way, I believe very strongly in collaboration. I am not a lone wolf, because what I said before about the through line or the core piece of what I notice in my people struggling with or their challenges is this idea of connection or disconnect. So we are meant to be community. Like, that's who and what we are hardwired to be.
Yes.
So it makes sense that a treatment model or a support model should also be a support network.
Yes.
I don't love to work in isolation, and I rarely think of myself in those terms. I am partnering with a psychiatrist if I'm lucky and we can collaborate, or a pediatrician, or when and all of this is with the permission of the client and they sign a release of information, and this is collaboration. I need to be really clear about that. But when I'm allowed that, you know, I can speak with, a school counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're working in the school, partnering with somebody out of the school with all our different personalities and areas of expertise and perspectives.
Oh, so you can do that. I mean, with their permission, you can collaborate with.
I think that's super important, because no person lives in a bubble. Like, as a social worker, by training, our whole thing is a person in an environment, which is the idea that if you heap a bunch of, and again, this is true for anybody practicing mental health counseling or therapy now, there's broad understanding of this. So I'm not just like, this is a social work thing.
Right.
But it's historically something that's a part of the social work training, is the idea that, like, you can give a person all of these tools, but if the environment they're going back into is still is still part of the issue, disorganized or maladaptive or dysfunctional or whatever we want to say,
right,
then the progress we want to see is going to be severely limited. So it is so important to simultaneously consider the person, provide them with skills and efficacy,
right,
and consider how to work with the larger environment. And that can be the first circle of their experience, which is, you know, family or school. And also, we can be considering things like sociocultural levels. For instance, you know, there's some very compelling research right now, or I guess data coming out about the level of burnout that caregivers and parents are experiencing right now.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Because if you can imagine, as a caregiver right now, you're inundated again, like I said at the beginning, inundated with these, with all of this information, all of this time, all of the time. Add to that, you've got parenting experts and parent blogs and people telling you how to do it on Instagram and TikTok and, and YouTube and whatever. So it always feels like, it can often feel like we're not doing enough. And that's defeating. So we do more, but we do less for ourselves. Things feel so much more charged and pressured. And then the push to have more for our kids or to be present in more and uninterrupted ways, while it's really important to have time with our kids and prioritize that.
Sure.
We also need balance. And so when I talk about sociocultural things, I mean the questions about what can we do as a community in terms of, you know, political or organizational or advocacy to allow parents and caregivers more access to community support. We can talk about, you know, paid time off, and we can talk about parental leave, and we can talk about making sure that there is, childcare that is accessible and quality and affordable, which is, by the way, a massive component of all of this we're talking about. And if we're talking about adolescent, young adult mental health, but we're not talking about childcare that is quality and accessible in early childhood, then we are we're pulling people out of the river without going upstream to see who's pushing them in.
All right.
So it is this large picture, and I think, you know, it is important to both look at the individual and also to consider the larger social context in which we all find ourselves, because the truth is, as all those astronauts will tell us, when they turn around and look out the window when they first get to space, it is jarring to see just how small and just how fragile it all seems. It all really is. Talk about perspective, which can be either very claustrophobic or very beautiful and very poetic to think, hey, like, we are literally all in the same boat. So I find that really, a significant point of connection is how it resonates for me.
We're talking to Ethan Weiss and his his website. Ethan, I used, almost said Eric. Ethan Weiss of Yes and Therapy, and the website is yesandtherapysrq.com. And we got about two more minutes. Eric, thanks so much for being here.
Ethan,
I think you ought to talk more to groups, or you ought to write a book, you ought to make films.
Oh man,
I like your ideas. By the way, your therapy is not that expensive. Your price is on your website. It's amazingly low. I don't know if you want to say it, but
I mean, I won't say it here because I would like, you know, if somebody reaches out to me,
sure.
The way that I navigate this is, you know, my price is on my website, and you can find me on Psychology Today with all my information. As long as I can, as long as my schedule allows, if somebody reaches out, I like to touch base with them for a few minutes, even just before we take steps forward, to make sure that all the pieces are logistically, they make sense. And then if I can't be of help, or if something doesn't make sense or something won't work, maybe I can be a part of referring out or helping them navigate the landscape. Sometimes it is just, I know this is true for me, having somebody just kind of give you that next step rather than the door in your face, or the feeling of the door in your face, can make all the difference. And I know this is true about a lot of my colleagues. They'll take the time to listen and make sure that you get the information you need. But so if somebody's thinking about psychotherapy, or they want to know more about my practice, you can reach me through my website. My number is, my practice, number is, 941. oh my goodness. I completely forgot, but it is on my website, and they are, you can reach me at info at, or Ethan at yesandtherapysrq.com.